Welcome to Wisconsin Life Weekend. I'm your host, Erica Janik. We all have our favorite weekend activities. Sleeping ranks very high for me. We visited with some third graders in Lac des Flambeaux to find out what they like to do on the weekend.
My name is Emma Mitchell. I'm a third grader. My favorite thing to do is sleep over a friend's house or a friend sleeping over my house.
My name is Leona. I'm from Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin. And my favorite thing to do is on the weekend is go play with my friends down the road. We just ride on our bikes.
I am Atlantis. Favorite thing I like to do on the weekend is play with my dog.
My name is Joseph Rainey. I usually just sleep in.
My name is Talia Labarge. My favorite thing to do on the weekend is go to my dad's or my grandma's. Because I could play on my tablet at my dad's and spend time with him.
My name is RG. My favorite thing to do on a weekend is to play on my PS4 or go to bed or watch YouTube or run outside.
Michelle Good is here with me. She likes to take walks back in time on the weekend.
About a year ago, I was working on an idea for a new radio show all about the state of Wisconsin, the cultural history, political history, Native people, all the way up to the present. And my plan was to start the show at the very, very beginning of the state, the foundation of the state, the geology. How did the land get here? So I start researching this stuff, and I start getting really, really amazed because I have lived in this state for most of my life, and the stuff I'm learning, I've never, ever heard these things before.
Well, now you have to tell me.
Okay. And I'm pretty sure that nobody else has heard them, too, because they're the kind of things that if you knew about them, they'd be, we have cheese heads, we would have rock heads, we would have all kinds of stuff. So here's the first one. Wisconsin has the longest geological history of any state in the U.S.
That's amazing.
It's about 2.8 billion years old.
Billion?
Billion. Longer than the Grand Canyon, longer than Alaska, which is actually pretty young. And the reason we have the longest geological history is because about 2.8 billion years ago, most of the U.S. was covered by a giant sea, except for an inverted triangle that came down from northern Wisconsin, extending down as far as Portage. Cartographers called this place Isle Wisconsin.
That sounds so romantic.
Well, actually, it wasn't. It was spewing volcanoes and acid rain, and you would have died instantly.
I like that it has that romantic name, though.
It
Isle
does.
Wisconsin.
Well, then I hear about this geologist, Marcia Bjornerud. She's a professor at Lawrence, and her thing is this incredible primordial history is still here. You can go touch it. You can go walk on it. You can go taste it if you want to. I wouldn't recommend it, but you could, and it's plainly visible. You just have to train your eye to look for it.
Cool.
So I called up Marcia and I asked her to take me for a walk back in time to see some of these geological wonders in person.
So where did you go?
Well, we met up at High Cliff State Park on the eastern shore of Lake Winnebago, which is set on the Niagara Escarpment. And as we leave the parking lot, heading up for the Mound Trail, we have to cross this other parking lot, which has fallen into disuse. You know, it's busted up slabs of asphalt and or blacktop or something. And as we're walking, I'm thinking to myself, why don't they fix this? I mean, it's uneven, it's dangerous, it's like a lawsuit waiting to happen. And then I notice Marcia actively looking for something on the ground. And then suddenly,
these are sort of mysterious, but I think they're places where the mud on the seafloor, so this would have been oozy mud made of lime that was made from the shells of tiny sea creatures. So it would have been deposited and wouldn't be completely dewatered. And once in a while, there'd be kind of a burp as the water came up, leaving these funny concentric patterns on the seafloor.
turns out the abandoned parking lot wasn't an abandoned parking lot at all. It was an ancient Silurian seafloor made of dolomite. It's basically the bedrock that the escarpment is built on. And immediately, I am back in time. I mean, I'm standing on something that's 420 million years old, and I can see that little 420 million-year-old sand burp frozen in time. I am hooked.
That's amazing.
As we're walking, Marcia explains to me that the Niagara Escarpment runs from Niagara Falls to Wisconsin. It exists because there's these two different kind of rocks, the dolomite, that ancient seabed, and shale. They're both there together. Well, the shale is really clay, so when it rains, it just kind of dissolves into mud. And the dolomite is really, really tough, and it resists weathering and erosion. But its downfall, literally, are the many cracks, these vertical cracks that run through it. And eventually, they cause large chunks of rocks to just split off and fall. And as the dolomite falls away, the escarpment retreats, moving back towards Niagara Falls. Marcia told me that it was once in central Wisconsin, near Wausau. Then we reach the area where you can really see the escarpment and not just the edge of the cliff.
There are cracks in these rocks. We call them joints. And they are dictating how the cliff is retreating, but they also are a huge problem for groundwater. So you can see there are cracks, and they have pretty consistent orientations. And they are super highways for groundwater.
So this is the part, actually the piece kind of right in front of us that's a little detached here from the wall. That's the part that of the escarpment right at this moment that's pulling away.
Right. Yeah, eventually those rocks will be eroded away, and a new set of cracks will open up with the assistance of gravity and water.
Probably right where we're standing
probably
right
about
now.
Here. Yeah. Well, we should get out of here.
And that wasn't a joke. According to Marcia, you never know when one of these cracks is going to appear. It could be a million years from now. It could be 10 minutes from now.
This is from a farm that must have existed here. And all these pesky glacial boulders were piled up over time into a fence that is still with us today.
I was going to say, how do you recognize a glacial boulder?
Well, you can see that these sort of lumpy ones are the local rock, the dolomite, that forms the escarpment itself. And they aren't as rounded, so they haven't moved very far. The glacier might have rolled them around a little bit, but the imports, the ones that have come from up north, are more rounded and subdued shapes. They don't have sharp edges. If you took a rock hammer, you could tell that many of them are igneous. So these are pre-Cambrian. They're from the time that Wisconsin had volcanoes and mountain belts. So we have gneisses and basalts and granites sprinkled amidst the dolomite.
And these pitted ones are the dolomite.
Yes.
And is that also that sea of pavement that we kind of walked across? Is that dolomite too?
That was the ancient seafloor of the Silurian. The texture and this pitting is partly from dissolution. So dolomite, like limestone, dissolves in rainwater, which is always slightly acidic.
Then we got to the highlight of the walk. We are standing on a cliff that juts out about 4 feet, hanging over nothing, with a 200-foot drop below. The cliff itself has a giant crack that goes down the middle of it, about 20 feet deep. To the left is a staircase that goes down into the crack, where you're surrounded by two towering sheer rock cliffs, 100 or 200 feet tall. And Marcia and I are looking at the front edge of the cliff that looks like it's about to topple into the forest floor far below.
Let's move back from the cliff because I'm afraid I'm going to... I think I'm going to take a step and fall on the cliff now.
Once we recovered, I asked Marcia, how much Wisconsin's climate has an effect on our geology?
The climate and the weather and the vegetation that result from those things very much affect the way that the topography evolves over time. And we can zoom backwards further in time, and glaciers obviously shaped the way we see rock formations today. So we see some of these very same rock units all around the southern part of the state, in the Madison area, and then over into the Driftless area as well. But they look really different because that region was never glaciated. It's the Driftless area. And so we see rather fragile chimney spires and castle rocks. There are lots of places.
Impossible-looking
exactly.
balancing acts.
Right, that would never have survived glaciation in the western part of the state. The rocks themselves, again, are from the tropical seas, but the erosion of the rocks in the Driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin is mainly from river action, and sometimes maybe much more torrential flow than we have in the rivers today. But that's it's an older landscape. So we're seeing what all of Wisconsin probably looked like prior to glaciation when we look at the topography of the Driftless area. And then the glaciers came through and scoured everything and subdued the topography in the rest of the state. But the southwestern corner preserves this older memory of the landscape as it was before the Pleistocene, the Ice Age.
So we decided it might be safer to move off the cliff and go down the staircase. And as you descend this rickety, moss-covered staircase, you enter into this natural amphitheater, and the birds and the forest just come alive.
Wow. Now, these are the same rocks that we saw back in the fence, right?
Right.
But they're so much more impressive in these giant slabs.
Yeah.
So that's millions of years we're looking at, right?
That's right. Yeah, let's do this. For me, geology is an interesting hybrid of the practical and the philosophical. There are lots of practical reasons for wanting or needing to know something about the rocks under your feet. We use them as resources, but there's also this kind of spiritual aspect, I think, of being deeply connected to a place and understanding its past and how it shapes us in subtle ways we might not even be aware of. I find it very satisfying to go to places like High Cliff or any place, even a fairly urbanized place, has sprung out of the natural history. And it's satisfying to have a sense of this palimpsest, this record that place records. The many layers of geologic history that we have here, and the combination and the diversity, I think are unparalleled.
I want to do that.
Well, Erica, you are in luck. Marcia says your best bet for time traveling is to check out a state park in your area. Many of them exist because of their geological features. And she's put together some materials and links to help get you started. You can check it out at WPR.org/next, along with a slideshow from our walk.
Do we get to see where you almost fell into the crack?
Yeah, it's all there.
My name is Vincent from Lac des Fambles, Wisconsin, and you're listening to Wisconsin Life Weekend.
This is Wisconsin Life Weekend. I'm Erica Janik. Coming up, we'll recreate a soap opera from the 1930s and talk about the beginnings of DIY shows in Wisconsin. We'll also hear from Milwaukee rapper Webster X. But first, my interview with Sagacious Levingston. Her name means wise, shrewd, clever. It's really an appropriate name for her. For many years, Sagacious felt like she was faking motherhood. The women she knew looked nothing like the mothers in books and on TV, and she felt like she was constantly trying to live up to what other people thought she should be. Rather than keep trying to change, though, Levingston decided to change the story with a group she calls Infamous Mothers.
I grew up around amazing women, amazingly Oh, God, I'm about to cry just thinking about these women. Where I come from, women on the south side of Chicago, women in low-income housing, what I experienced with moms who were tough. Tough was their form of love. Their mothering met the intensity of that environment.
Was mothering and the idea of motherhood something that drew you to pursue graduate studies?
When I came here, I actually came to study men in love in literature, right? And then men in prison in literature. And a professor here was teaching a course on feminism. And I tried my best to stay away from anything that was associated with feminism because I'd heard these horrible things about feminism. But this professor is somebody I really respected. And I knew that if she was teaching it, it couldn't have been all bad. So I took the course. I fell in love with it.
Well, that's quite a change. What did you love about feminism?
Prior to taking that course, no one ever told me that I was worth studying as a woman, right? I didn't even realize how invisible I was to myself and how invisible other women were to me. And when I enrolled in that course, it changed me.
Is that when you started thinking about what became Infamous Mothers?
The idea for Infamous Mothers came from my research. I was reading a woman's work, and she talked about something called outlaw moms. And these outlaw moms were moms who had made up their mind that they were going to break the rules. They were the moms who, in my mind, if the rest of society says bedtime for children is 8:30, these moms were going to say, no, my kids are going to go to bed at 9:30, right? So they were the moms who kind of lived outside of the rules. And I realized the moms that I was talking about in my research, they were the moms, they needed something a little bit more. They needed something heavier. These were the moms who were teen moms, single moms, women we call baby mamas, women who once used drugs or women who were once sex workers. And so I needed a term that would be able to be, that was heavy enough to fit those realities. And so outlaw moms didn't seem to be appropriate for this group. So I chose infamous because when we think about women who are infamous, we think about people who are reprehensible, people that have bad reputations. So that was the starting point, the women who were starting from this place in life. But then in the same way that African-American culture used the term bad to mean good, I wanted infamous to also carry another kind of connotation. I wanted these moms to not just be the moms that we see for the so-called bad or things that we judge. I wanted to look at how these moms actually made a difference in society.
Tell me a little bit about your childhood. What kind of models of motherhood were you seeing around you?
I've come from four generations of sex workers. My great-grandma was a sex worker. My grandma was a sex worker. My dad was part of the sex industry. My sister was part of the sex industry. I knew that that wasn't for me, but I still found myself engaging in risky behavior. And I was having all of these children, and I didn't have the self-esteem to protect myself because I felt like, well, if I do this, then this person's not going to want to be with me, then I can't get the validation that I need, then I can't go through the world being smart because I have to get the validation first, then I can be smart, right? So there was this whole process that I was trying to go through, and I had to overcome that. One day I had to wake up and say, I have these string of kids. And, you know, when you mess up one kid, you can blame the kid. The kid was a fluke, right? But if you mess up five, folks are like, who is your mama? Who did this? And unleash these folks into the world, right? So I looked up and I had all of this responsibility and I had to do something about it. When I started this research, I was interested in all mothers, right? And I'm still interested in all moms. I didn't see stories like mine. You know, one of the things that I say a lot is that I found myself and women like me amputating parts of myself, ourselves, to fit into these neat boxes. And after a while, you cut off enough pieces, there's just nothing left. What I noticed was the women who were damaged most by the mothering narratives were moms like me, moms who had come from impoverished Black backgrounds, moms who had multiple children by multiple men, moms who were teen moms or moms who were on drugs. So I knew that if I could help empower that group of mom, it would kind of trickle up.
So your name?
Yes.
I love your name. And it feels like a portent in a way to a lot of the work that you're doing. Tell me about your name.
So my name is interesting, right? My mom has a college degree, and she gave me the middle name Tracy from Tracy, I think Quartermain or somewhere from the soap operas, right? My dad, who has no college degree, used to read the dictionary, and he named me Sagacious. And I asked my dad, why did you name me Sagacious? Because I'm the only one in my I have 11 other siblings. Their names are like Chandra, Sean, Kyle, Paul, Isaac, right? I'm the only Sagacious, right? So why me? And my dad said, because I wanted you to live up to your name. That was important to me. And so as time went on, when I became an adult, I said, Dad, there's a word right across from my name. Salacious. You know, one letter different, it would have been the pole for me, Dad. I would have been right there swinging on the pole, right? And here I am at the podium, right? Like, that was one letter different. And then I realized that he understood that, and that name was very intentional. By the time he got to me, he was saying, enough. There's something that's happening in our family. And if I call you something different, if I call you wise every day, then maybe you'll rise.
What's changed for you now that you've claimed this narrative, started this group? What's different?
There's something really humbling when you carve out a space for yourself and then other women say, this fits me too. It has really made me understand how universal so many of these experiences are. It's made me have a deeper appreciation about what it means to be a human. Right. And it sounds kind of cheesy, but it's not. I never would have thought that a woman who may have grown up in Lake Forest, Illinois, would have had something in common with me. Right. Because we're taught that class and race is what divides. You know, class and race is what kind of shapes your identity. But there are these things that happen. Like, no matter how rich you are, you get sick, you die, you have children. These are all universal things that happen no matter what. Right. But there are other things that are universal that happens. People who are very wealthy find themselves saying, I can't tell my story because I will lose status in this community. People who are not very wealthy find themselves saying, I can't tell my story because I don't have the means to tell my story. I have nothing to lose. I just don't have the means, right? In both cases, people are being silenced. And I get to see that and help construct ways for people to tell their stories. And that right there is... It's given me a stronger sense of purpose. It's made me a more confident person. It's made me realize that I do matter.
That was Sagacious Levingston. She's the founder of the group Infamous Mothers and the author of a new book by the same name. What did you want to be when you grew up? The third graders at Lac des Flambeaux have some ideas.
My name is Emma Mitchell. I'm a third grader. I want to be a doctor.
I am Atlantis. I grew up, I want to be a lawyer.
My name is Joseph Rainey. When I grew up, I want to be a teacher.
My name is Summer Smith. I want to be a teacher when I grow up.
When I grow up, I want to be a teacher.
My name is Brooklyn Bluebird.
My name is Denise LaBarge. When I grow up, I want to be a YouTuber.
My name is RG. I'm a third grader at Lac des Flambeaux Public School. It's not like sort of a job, but it's a YouTuber. Make gaming videos.
My name is Vincent, and I'm from Lac des Flambeaux Public School.
I want to be when I grow up is be a mayor or a police officer.
My name is Talia LaBarge. I want to be the Air Force.
My name is Jack LaBarge.
When I grow up, I want to be a football player.
My name is Mylicia Rivera, and I am a third grader from Lac des Flambeaux Public School.
When I grow up, I would like to be the first female president.
None of them said soap opera star, did they? You might have heard that WPR is celebrating its centennial this year. And as we've been digging through our history, we've discovered some real gems. We've also discovered that a lot of what we were doing in the past is very similar to what we do today. From HGTV and the Food Network to Martha Stewart, apartment therapy, and Domino, we can't seem to get enough cooking, design, home, and just life advice. It's something radio has covered since its early days. Here in Wisconsin, we had the Homemakers Program. I should tell you that I became obsessed with this show a few years ago. Its name sounds retro, but here's a list of show topics from July 1940. Canning, stain removal, buying dishes, how to pick the best shrubs for the garden. I still need help with that stuff. And listen to this from 1947. Host Aline Hazard is interviewing chef Carson Gully on salad dressings.
A couple of weeks or so ago, Carson Gully, chef at the University Dormitories and Commons, gave us some interesting suggestions on the use of herbs and vinegars in foods. Today we've asked him to speak especially of salad dressings. Mr. Gully, there is variety in salad dressings, isn't there?
Definitely. Salad dressings alone is the secret of success in creating a wide range of variety of salad combinations.
And here's Chef Tyler Florence from the Food Network.
When I'm talking to people about how to actually make something taste good, one thing I always bring up is the art of making a classic vinaigrette. It's really easy, and it's a quick way to make a salad absolutely sing.
The Homemakers Program began in 1929, but didn't have a regular host until Aline Hazard took the job in 1933. She remained at the helm of the show for 32 years. Hazard saw her program as a way to improve household efficiency, but also she had to entertain her listeners. Kind of like a cross between Martha Stewart and Oprah Winfrey, a knowledgeable educator on modern homemaking and a trusted friend. Hazard came up with lots of creative ways of delivering information, including soap operas in the late 1930s. We haven't found any recordings of these, only scripts. So, of course, we couldn't resist recreating one of them and talking about it. You'll hear me, Maureen McCollum, and Michelle Good. To our ears, it sounds pretty comical. We had some trouble even getting through the first read. This morning, we bring you the second in a series of broadcasts from the Department of Physical Education for Women at the University of Wisconsin. It's a dramatization again, entitled Conserve Energy Through Relaxation. As the first scene opens, our friend Susan Jenks and her husband Paul hear a familiar sound.
Oh, it seems as though I just went to bed. I haven't slept a wink all night. Paul?
Yes, dear?
Paul, please turn that off.
All right.
I don't see why we need an alarm clock. I never closed my eyes.
Why, dear, you've been in bed 9 hours.
But I was so tired, I couldn't sleep.
Well, then why don't you get someone to help with the work?
You know I can't stand to have anyone in the house. They make me nervous.
Well, business is no picnic either, dear. The pressure is terrific. I can't even find time to go to the dentist.
Well, I guess we won't stay for breakfast with the Jenks. It looks as if it might be quite a struggle. We'll join Susan Jenks at 10 o'clock. She finally got her children, Dottie and Bill, on the school bus and is now talking to her grocer on the phone.
But, Mr. Black, I asked you to save me a roast. I thought you understood. This isn't the most aggravating thing. Lamb chops? But the children won't eat lamb.
Modern life is like that for all of us. Everyone has a million things to do. Days are full of complexities, nerve-wearing tasks, and worries. Her groceries ordered, Susan Jenks swept the house, answered 2 letters, and began a shopping tour of downtown stores for a weary 2 hours. And so, with the day only half over, Susan collapses into a booth at the nearest drugstore for a quick pickup, a cup of black coffee. She rubs her forehead as she waits to be served, for by now she has developed a headache.
Well, Susan Jenks, what brings you into the drugstore at this time of day?
Oh, Ruth,
Sit down. I don't see how you keep looking so fit with all those physical education classes you have to teach every day. I only have 2 children, and I'm a nervous wreck.
The heck's wrong with you?
I can't sleep. I have a headache all the time. I never get caught up with my work. Everything is wrong.
Oh, come now, Susan. Relax. You'll last longer.
Relax? Relax? How can I relax when I'm all tied up in knots?
I sure can see that. Some people bite their nails, others twist their hair, squirm and wiggle, or blink their eyelids. I see you blinking your eyelids. All are indicative of inner stresses, which is just another way of saying they can't relax.
Can't read my script because I'm blinking.
You're blinking too much.
But there's nothing wrong with me. The doctor said so. But I feel sort of stiff all the time. No, stiff isn't the right word.
Perhaps you mean tense.
That's it.
Well, our muscles should have a certain amount of tenseness or we wouldn't be able to walk around and do our work.
What is a muscle anyway? I thought only prize fighters and football players had them.
You want it in simple English or in scientific language?
Oh, I don't care. Just as long as I can understand it.
All right, well, saddle up. Here we go. A muscle.
I'm going to regret that.
The muscle is a bundle of fibers. Why aren't my interactions like this at a coffee shop?
I'm crying now.
That was an excerpt from Conserve Energy Through Relaxation. We had some questions about that.
Did women back then not talk about their feelings with one another?
No, women did, but in private. You know, this is the expectations of what a woman was going to do is that they were going to take care of their home and family. And so I think a lot of women felt pressure not to talk about, and I think still do, pressure not to talk about how hard these things are and trying to balance all of them.
Yeah, because it seems so academic. I mean, there's no compassion.
So this was probably the first time she thought about her muscles.
Probably. But yeah. I mean, the point of the Homemakers program is to teach lessons from the University of Wisconsin through soap operas, through interviews, through field recordings. And so I think some of the academic talk that makes us laugh and seem silly is also the goal of the show was imparting knowledge from these various home economists, things that would help women in their everyday life. I don't feel like, I mean, you never know people's intent, but having read this and many of the other scripts, I can't imagine that they also didn't find it a little bit silly.
Okay.
Like, I think that's partly why they were doing it. I mean, soap operas were inherently melodramatic and over the top. And that's what they were mimicking, because that was the most popular form of radio entertainment at this time period. And so
soap operas were.
Soap operas. Hmm. So they were trying to mimic that style and teach about domestic science.
Well, it's fascinating in terms of if this is meant as like fun but educational piece. It really does say a lot about, we were laughing about it, but it really says a lot about what women's lives were back then. I mean, the fact that, like, that whole, this is your skeletal system and your muscles bend and your muscles are attached to your brain. Like, this is a woman with children who's familiar with her body to a certain extent, at least enough to give birth, but she doesn't quite understand that her body is made up of muscles and a skeletal system, and that's a little frightening. I mean, it's funny if it isn't real.
Educational programming like the Homemakers program and a lot of the other things that we broadcast on WHA were, especially the daytime programming, were for farm wives who didn't really have people to talk to. Their nearest neighbor lived miles away, and maybe they had very limited schooling.
Well, then I don't feel so bad about Susan not knowing, like, that she has muscles and a skeletal system.
We then decided to read it again, and it really changed the way we all saw the story.
A muscle is a bundle of fibers. Each fiber is composed of many smaller fibers called fibrils. If you'll just bend your elbow like so, here we go, bending our elbows, and bring your hand toward yourself, you can feel the bicep muscle between your shoulder and your elbow. The little demonstration will show you that a muscle is capable of contracting, then returning to its original length or relaxing. Come on, let's keep doing it. Try it.
Well, for goodness sake, will you look at that? What if you're physically worn out and too tired to rest?
obviously have gone beyond your energy bounds. And when that happens, your muscles are in a state of mild contraction, which means they cannot rest because the nerves are constantly carrying impulses and energy is constantly being used without being readily restored. When this happens, you need to relax. I mean, deliberately relax all your muscles. In fact, when muscles are completely relaxed, they're limp and motionless.
That sounds like a good idea, but who can do it?
You have to work at it and concentrate.
All right, I'll try it. If you're an example of what relaxation can do, it's worth a try.
Well, I can't very well lie down right here and show you, Susan, but one of the best ways to relax completely is first to lie down on a bed. You're back with your arms lying at your side. Now, the idea is to get your whole body feeling limp and motionless.
Really think about feeling limp.
Some folks call this progressive relaxation. Start with your arms and concentrate on making them feel real limp and heavy. So heavy that they feel as though they'd fall right through the mattress. Then work up to the shoulders, neck, trunk, and finally down to the legs and feet. And you'll find that your sleep will be much more restful.
The relaxation thing that Ruth talks about, that sounds like what?
Like tensing your muscles. You hear about that if you go to a yoga class.
Yes,
today.
It's like the meditation thing of like relaxing the muscles.
Scan your body.
Scan, pay attention to everything.
Yeah. In a certain way, it's very progressive, too, with all that.
It's progressive
mind
relaxation.
Over body.
It is progressive.
Exactly.
That was Maureen McCollum, Michelle Good, and me reading and discussing Conserve Energy Through Relaxation. You can hear the full radio drama and all of our asides and laughter online at WPR.org/next.
My name is Talia from Lac des Flambeaux, Wisconsin, and you're listening to Wisconsin Life Weekend.
My name is Preston Allen. I'm from Lac des Flambeaux. My favorite music is rock and roll music.
My name is Brooklyn Bluebird. I'm in third grade, and my favorite music is pop because I listen to it a lot with my brother.
My name is Talia Labarge. My favorite kind of music is hip-hop.
My name is Arjiat. My favorite music to listen to is Skrillex. Like dubstep.
My name is Mylicia Rivera. My favorite kind of music is classical music.
My name is Summer Smith. I'm a third grader. The music I like to listen to is country.
I am Atlantis. I like to listen to rap.
Welcome back to Wisconsin Life Weekend. I'm Erica Janik. Over the years, the Milwaukee area has had a handful of musicians make it big, from Liberace to Steve Miller and Al Jarreau. But there's never been a defining sound of Milwaukee. In the late 70s, New York sounded like hip-hop and punk. Grunge spawned from Seattle in the early 90s. Today, Atlanta has trap music. Maureen McCollum recently talked about this with Mitch Kreitzman. He's a digital content intern with Radio Milwaukee, who explored the concept of a signature sound of Milwaukee and whether it was hurting the city's music scene.
So when we think about music, when you think about Milwaukee music in particular, do you think it has a signature sound?
I really don't think it does. You know, there are a couple bands from Milwaukee that have made it really big and have become sort of legendary, at least in Milwaukee. The biggest example is Violent Femmes in the early 80s. You know, them right along with REM really sort of created alternative rock, and that's a really big thing. Like, that's a huge accomplishment from them. And they're by far the biggest thing to ever come out of Milwaukee. But now when you look at what Milwaukee music does, it's incredibly eclectic and diverse. I mean, what's so great about music in Milwaukee, if you're a fan, is that you can basically find a good artist or band for any conceivable genre. You know, you want alternative hip-hop, there's Webster X. You want mainstream hip-hop, there's Ishtar. You want electropop, there's Gold. You want alternative rock, there's So Low. I mean, there's basically anything you might want to listen to in music, there's going to be at least one band here that can do it well. And that's what I really love about Milwaukee music.
So when you've talked with different musicians from Milwaukee about this idea of maybe a lack of a Milwaukee signature sound, what do they really have to say about it?
I really think the diversity is something that people really care about in the city, for sure. Because, you know, I talk to people from a lot of different genres, and they feel that it's really nice to not have some kind of blueprint that they feel like they have to go off of as musicians. They feel like they can perform any kind of music they want without people thinking, oh, that's not really what Milwaukee sounds like. And so that's something really nice that I think people really take advantage of.
In your article, you kind of talked about how with that lack of the signature sound, it's kind of hard to sell Milwaukee on a national level, maybe to the major record labels or the powers that be within the music industry. Does that really matter?
Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it kind of does, because so just use Webster X as an example. He's becoming one of the biggest artists in Milwaukee currently. But what he does is very unique to him. No one else really sounds like he does in Milwaukee. And so if a record label really likes Webster X and they want to sign him, they can't really look at him and say, well, we might as well go check out Milwaukee to see if there's other people like this that could be popular. It's definitely not beneficial in the way that record labels kind of struggle to get their head around what kind of bands are in Milwaukee, because the music industry moves so fast that they don't necessarily have the time to come here and really learn to find out what the scene is like. They need some kind of blueprint to know what it sounds like before they come here and check it out. I suppose one other thing that I might want to mention is just that, you know, Milwaukee's kind of waiting on that one really big person to propel us to the next level. And, you know, that was Prince from Minneapolis. And, you know, Milwaukee's never really seen something like that, where there's just one artist that hits such a level of superstardom that, you know, everyone else kind of follows suit because they were so big. And, you know, as Webster X grows, I think he could be somebody that provides that role for Milwaukee music. But, well, you know, only time will tell and that kind of stuff.
Speaking of Webster X, his animated delivery and dramatic music videos helped to generate a lot of buzz for the experimental hip-hop musician. He busted onto Milwaukee's music scene a few years ago with his debut mixtape, Desperate Youth. He recently released his first full-length album, Daymares. Maureen McCollum talked with Webster X about this introspective album that he says was rooted in a time that wasn't so great for him. Don't wanna be dark, I don't wanna be dark, I don't wanna be
dark. Daymares is an embodiment of the duality of dark and light, because, like, growing up, I was always a pretty positive kid. I had a great upbringing. My family was very supportive. They're both Ethiopian, like, immigrant parents. I've just had a really unique background that I've always kind of, like, celebrated. So late 2013 to all of 2014, pretty much I was in and out of, like, just these new feelings of realizing that I can be anxious, and I had depressive, like, points and stuff like that in my life. Yeah, it was just a really eye-opening experience, because I really, like, anxiety and depression and all that type of stuff wasn't a thing that was talked about in my house a lot. But when this time period hit, I couldn't feel like myself. I couldn't really get out of bed, like, motivated to do anything.
Did you feel like there was something that triggered these feelings within you, or is it...
1,000%. I mean, the topics that I talk about, especially in the album, too, is, like, dropping out of college and having to prove to my parents that I could actually pursue a career in art, because of the fact that, like, when I was in my junior year, I think it was first semester, that was when the Desperate Youth mixtape came out in Milwaukee, and it was doing super well. And I was like, I kind of figured out what I want to do with the rest of my life. That made me realize that I should at least try to pursue it full time. And I'm glad that I did make that decision, because it's all paying off right now.
Right.
But yeah, it was a really growing pain period. That's really the best way I could put it. From there, I had to make the right decisions to move forward, but that took a lot of mental energy.
I mean, of course it's going to be therapeutic for you, but yes. At any point in that process where you're like, maybe this music that I'm writing will help others who have found themselves in a similar situation.
Yes, 1,000%, because one of the biggest things that I've learned is when I'm looking back at that time period, I realized that I went through it for a reason. I needed that really, really dark part of me to come out, so I could really be able to talk to people about, you know, pretty much anything and be able to relate to as many people as I could. And when I realized that, I was like, if I made an album, like, with the basis of that idea in mind, I knew it could relate to a whole bunch of people, you know.
Let's talk about some of the individual songs. course, mm-hmm. you don't want to pick a favorite. But are there certain songs on this album that really stick out to you and maybe even you go back to and you're like, I can't believe that came out of me. That's amazing.
Yes. Wasting hours in bed all day long in my head, falling deep, so deep I'm fading, I'm gone, will I ever come back again?
Until I is a song that I thought was just sonically, like, it really just blows me away as far as how it's just produced simply. And that was produced by a dude named Boathouse in Chicago, who's a part of the label that I have distribution through called Closed Sessions. There's another song called Moods on the project. That's one of my favorites just because of, like, the delivery that I had on it.
Get the magic in the palm of my hand, but now I keep the magic behind the curtain. We're too concerned with the shit that we're concerning. I spit the fire through the wire like a sermon. We saw the fire on the north side burning. Put the flames out, looking for a way out. What you say now, you can't be fake now. Put your blame down, keep your head up now. Fake.
I wrote it really, really quickly. It all came out supernaturally.
I really like Lost Ones because I loved the beat
yes,
on that.
Another
it reminds
favorite
me
one.
Of like Stranger Girl. Things.
Yeah, yeah, of course. A lot of people thought that song is entirely sample free, which is just even cooler.
Oh, it's amazing. But I also like in that song how, you know, you're reflecting on your childhood. You're talking about going to visit Ethiopia.
Yes.
And you're talking about like partying at the UWM dorms, which,
yes.
you know, many people in Milwaukee could relate to at some point in their life.
Yes. Yes. Right. I mean, the first lyrics are, we should probably start off from the top. Young Ethiopian boy with the life coming. Immigrant parents, but they gave me two stars. Had to pour it out, I could see the truth, dog. At 15, taking flights overseas, Ethiopia's world, I just could not believe. Really trying to paint the picture for the listener, as in, like, alright, we had those first two dark tracks, but Lost Ones is really like, alright, here is the story, so you can kind of get familiar with it, you know? So mm-hmm. I'm telling my life story, but I'm also talking about this really dark period of time just because, like, I wanted to shine light on something that people really wouldn't expect slash doesn't really get talked about that much, especially in hip-hop. Yeah, that depressive and anxiety-ridden, like, growing pain period that I went through and, like, after I released my debut mixtape, Desperate Youth.
So you grew up in Milwaukee, right?
I did. Since the jump, north side of Milwaukee.
Both of your parents were born in Ethiopia.
Yep.
Is being the son of immigrants, does that influence much of your music? Or, like, I mean, are there sounds of Ethiopia that inspire some of the work that you create?
Right. So the sounds of Ethiopia and the stuff that my dad would play, because my dad was also a professional musician in Ethiopia and was he's very well known. They never really seeped their way into my music. Like, people were always like, you should sample your dad, blah, blah, blah. And I've always, like, really considered it, but it just never really happened. The East Africa, and especially Ethiopia in its own right, is, like, a very different country as far as, like, the general vibe from the rest of Africa for the most part. And as far as musically, like, it has those same African rhythms that are, like, very lively. But there's also, like, a lot of these, like, this dark jazz feel to it.
Hmm.
That isn't necessarily, like, dark in the sense of, like, it's, like, depressive music. It's still super happy, but the melodics of it aren't, like, na 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 na. It's more like, na, 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 na. Like, I don't know. It grabs you in. So, if anything, maybe some of that stuff came in, but at the end of the day, I never was, like, influenced by that much stuff. But my dad and my mom just really influenced me as being, like, just a solid down-to-earth person in the sense of, like, treating the next person like your neighbor, you know? They always really instilled that in me.
That was Maureen McCollum with Milwaukee artist Webster X. For more than half a century, clergy from the Apostle Islands have gathered in June to bless local boats for safe passage. It's a practice with a long history, beginning centuries ago in Mediterranean fishing communities. We attended the blessing a few years ago.
I like the fact that they have a galvanized bucket of Lake Superior holy water and the cedar bough, and then that's how they bless the boats going by. Never saw 5 gallons of holy water before.
The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you now and forever.
It's an old ritual that went on years and years ago. It blessed the fishing boats every spring to have a good harvest. And it just kind of extended over into recreational boaters, too, or anybody, kayakers. You'll see kayakers out there and canoes and powerboats, sailboats. It can't hurt to have God on your side, right?
That's the
Lord, O my soul.
You lay the beams of your chambers in the waters above. You make the clouds your chariot. You ride on the wings of the wind. You make the winds your messengers.
Amen.
This year's Blessing of the Fleet will take place in early June in Bayfield. We hope you enjoyed our Wisconsin Life Weekend 1,000%. Find more about and from our show at WPR.org/next. This hour was produced by Maureen McCollum.
All right, well, saddle up. Here we go.
Michelle Good.
Relax. Relax.
And me. Modern life is like that for all of us. With help from Peter Bryant.
Business is no picnic either, dear.
Malcolm Brett.
Here you are, ma'am. That'll be 20 cents, please.
And Kian Hartke.
How about this, Milwaukee?
Thanks to our cheerleader, Adam Friedrich. Technical heroics from Steve Gotcher, with help from Joe Hartke. Thanks so much for listening.